microchip, the internet, the iPhone, as well as AI and nanotechnology are technologies that have changed the world. Technology is a key pillar of geopolitics, and due to this, we will be publishing a deep dive into the geopolitics of technology soon, and thought it would be a good idea to discuss the topic before the deep dive hits the website. To discuss the report and the topic, I have geopolicy founder Adnan Khan. I want to remind everyone that you can find us on all major social media platforms where you can subscribe and you'll never miss a thing. Adnan, AI is the next big thing. How has technology become so important? If we look at the economy, the military development, and just survival, it all runs on technology.
Yeah, absolutely. If we look at what technology fundamentally is the application of knowledge and research for practical use. So that definition of technology, if you think about it, it goes into every aspect of your life, you know, traveling, security, survival. So you find the first technology is considered the simple stone tools, which were used in early history. And for trial and error, the people at the time, they're able to sculpt tools into a shape which they can use. Then we see that fur and animal skin, this was used to keep warm, and this was when humans were able to survive in cold climates and they traveled around the world. The Industrial Revolution, it gave us the steam engine, gave us railways, gave us telegraph, really revolutionized how people lives. So technology really, it allows you to overcome limitations, it allows you to overcome your geography, and allows people to survive. If I give you the example of the British Empire, before the steam engine, before steam-powered vessels, to go from the UK, you went around Spain, through the Mediterranean, and then when the Suez Canal was built, you went through there. But prior to that, you went through the Euphrates, the Tigris, over to India. Now, before the steam-powered engine, or steam-powered ships, to be more accurate, it took you 6 months, and you had to wait for the part of the year where the wind was going in the right direction. So it would take 6 months to go from the UK to the Indian colony. Once steam-powered vessels came about, this was done in a matter of weeks. So that's just one example of the impact technology had, and I'm sure we're going to touch on loads of examples of technology that really changed the way people live. So the application of knowledge and research for practical use, this is what technology is. And absolutely, that would impact the economy, it would impact your military, it would impact your development. And if you want to survive, you make use of technology, from simple tools to the most advanced machines that we have today.
So it makes sense that countries with the most advanced technology are actually the key powers in the world. Would you say that's where the intersection between geopolitics and technology meet?
Yeah, absolutely. History shows us actually that people and nations, the ones that develop technology, they become powerful. We mentioned the British Empire. Industrialization really turned them into a power. There is a question actually, would the British Empire have been a power if they weren't the first to industrialize, or if they didn't industrialize at all? What technology does is it gives you advantage. So by industrializing, what it did to Britain was it turned into a superpower. It allowed her to develop a navy that was the size of the next two navies. And that made Britain a power. It made her the number one nation in the world. It made everyone try and compete with her. It gave her an advantage over everybody else. So whoever understands technology and develops it, it has a big impact on geopolitics because it allows you to be powerful than everybody else.
Britain agreed, I think, really, if we look post-World War II, the US has been the leading nation in technology. How did it actually achieve this, and how did it maintain its position? Because it has been some time now.
So the US, their innovation really is a broad-based system that's built upon and includes public-private partnerships, government-funded research, public venture capital initiatives, and a huge private sector. So this obviously wasn't built overnight. It was built over time. And what you find is prior to World War II, the United States, it developed railways, but it wasn't the technological leader in the world. What you find is the needs actually of World War II led to the emergence of the national security state. And this led to the expansion transformation of US resources in order to deal with the needs of a permanent war. So this led to the Manhattan Project, which led to the development of the nuclear bomb, which was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. However, in 1957, America went into panic. That was the year when the Soviets sent the first satellite into space, Sputnik, as it was known. And this really shocked the US because the US believed that they developed nuclear weapons and because it was the power, really, that turned the tide in World War II, that how is it the Soviets, who were defeated, really, and decimated in World War II, how were they able to develop this advanced technology? So what that led to was the establishment of the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA. And this is quite an interesting agency. So this agency was quite unique in that one of the reasons America didn't launch the first satellite was because most of America's agencies really were only planning for a very short horizon. They were thinking 2 to 5 years. And what America realized is they needed a department that was thinking over the horizon. So they were thinking 10, 20 years ahead. And obviously the corporations in America and most agencies, that wasn't the time span that they were actually looking at. So what DARPA did is it came to play the role of an intermediary that facilitated and acted as a middleman for researchers, entrepreneurs. It connected startup firms with venture capitalists. And today, DARPA, it has a long shopping list of innovation. It created the semiconductor chip. It invented GPS. It invented human-computer interface, voice recognition. And the internet, out of all things, came from DARPA. Now, interestingly, DARPA isn't allowed to patent technology and to keep technology. Its job is to bring people together, different institutions, different sections of American society, to ensure technology develops. So this is where the private sector comes in, because they're the ones that commercialize it. So whilst DARPA invents the technology, it's the private sector in America that commercializes it. And that's when we get hold of it. The iPhone is a good example. And then finally, let's not forget Silicon Valley, the transistor, which is central to the semiconductor. It was invented in Silicon Valley. So America, really, the needs of permanent war is what led to the development of innovation in America. And since then, really, America has created a broad-based system which leads to innovation in America. And that's why it's the number one nation. In fact, if you just do a basic Wikipedia search of inventions since World War II, you'd find a very small percentage are not from the US. Everything from the CD, from the internet, from the minute that you probably can't remember to the biggest machines, what you find is America actually who invented them and is leading the way in them.
One thing that came to mind when you were discussing the relationship between the venture capitalist and the government is Musk and Trump. Is that kind of a modern day example of this relationship?
It is in one way, but the Musk and Trump relationship is quite unique, because you've got the world's richest man who's very good friends, or was actually, with the president of America. But throughout American history, what you find is the largest corporations have always been very close to government. They get subsidies, they get the direction from the government where America's going, and also the impact policy as well. But Trump is obviously the president, and Musk is a corporate leader who, you know, spent a lot of money on developing the electric vehicles, electric batteries, and refuelable rockets. The DARPA agency is much more than that. It brings, its job is to bring together America's top inventors and venture capitalists and things like that. So the American system is much broader. It's actually quite complex. It's, you know, people try to put it down to America's innovative because of its culture. America's innovative because it has a free market. Actually, the innovation in America is much more complicated than that.
So obviously, US has taken the lead, but In recent years, we've seen China closing the gap. How has China so rapidly developed economically and to the point where it's now challenging the US in terms of its in terms of superiority in tech?
Yeah, absolutely. China's view towards technology is rooted in its history. As far as the Chinese are concerned, they were the global superpower for centuries, for millennia. Then the Europeans turned up in the early 1800s with their industrialization and with their technology. And they were able to colonize China. In fact, they humiliated China. They called that period the center of humiliation. And the conclusion the Chinese came to was they fell behind technologically to the Europeans. That's why they were conquered. So once the Japanese were defeated and they reunified the country and kicked out all foreigners, what you find is the first thing Chinese did is they turned to the Soviets in order to develop technology. So actually, they got quite a lot of technology in the 1950s, 1960s from the Soviet Union. But they weren't able to build upon that because of domestic unrest. So in the late 1950s, the Great Leap Forward was a complete disaster. And then in the 1960s to the early 70s, what you find is Mao's Cultural Revolution. So there's a lot of instability within China, which didn't allow for technological development. Really, where China started to develop was the Open Reform era. So we're talking from 1979. And actually, that was the first time where scientists were not seen as anti-communist. Because prior to that, science and scientists, they were seen as Western. They were seen as anti-communist. After 1979, it even became okay to commercialize technology. Prior to that, what you had was research institutes, you had state-owned enterprises, and they dealt with technology. And in the modern era, what we see is China's made very good use of acquisitions. It's made extensive use of cyber theft and even espionage as well to leapfrog technological development. Probably the key institution when we look at China is the Chinese Academy of Sciences. This is probably the closest institute to America's DARPA. It's not exactly the same, but it's probably the closest China has, which is very similar to DARPA. The other thing to keep in mind is China had a strategy in 2015 called Made in China 2025, which was their attempt to make sure over 70% of what they manufacture is from domestic sources. So it was a strategy to upgrade China's manufacturing capabilities. And 10 years on, it's been a phenomenal success. Although there's one or two areas where China's still behind, what you find is when it comes to robotics, when it comes to semiconductor chips, China has made extensive progress in these areas. So yes, China has come a long way. China has finally managed to leave its history in the past. And in fact, as I'm sure we're going to discuss, in quite a few areas, China's actually even leapfrogged America.
So Adan, if you had to kind of pick out key ingredients that a nation needed to actually become a lead runner in tech, what would you say are the key ingredients to do that?
So I think this is an important question because I don't think you can really boil it down to a couple of things. There's some strategic high-level things that are needed and some more specific tactical things that are needed. So obviously the country's vision, the country having a view towards technology being a good thing. I mean, if you view technology as Western and you view it as a negative thing, then you're not really going to develop. The other thing you also need, you need leaders who promote technological development, innovation, and not just by words, but they do it by investing in new tech areas. They provide an environment where companies and individuals and researchers can come together and share knowledge and share information. And so that leads to the exchange of ideas and it leads to innovation as well. Then what you really need at a more tactical level is, you know, researchers need to be given funding. They need to be allowed to research and produce papers. These people need to be linked up with venture capitalists because you need funding. Obviously, the ideas need to be tested as well. So you've got two things there. You've got the environment needs to exist, which is really from the state. So, you know, the regulatory system, the private sector, support when it comes to funding and regulation as well. Then at a more tactical level, there needs to be a culture where technology is pursued and seen as a solution to problems in their economy. If you can combine these two together, you will see technological development. And that's why if you look across the world, there isn't that many countries that actually invent or innovate technology. Most countries, what they do, they take existing tech, however new it is, and then they do things with it. Very few countries actually invent new technology. In fact, I think over 90% of tech development after World War II has really been from America.
So that's fine. That makes sense. My question is, do all nations generally focus on the same things in terms of technology to develop? So, for example, militarily, or is it actually heavily influenced by worldview?
Okay, I think what you're saying is, do you need to have an ideology to innovate and develop technology? Now, if you look at history, if you look at the Soviet Union, if you look at America, these are ideological nations. But if you look at the Nazis, if you look at going back to the Romans, they all invented technology. So your technological drive can be ideological driven, or it could be for other reasons as well. So you do need a reason to develop technology, because if you look across the world today, there's many countries that don't develop technology. They don't innovate. They don't have the environment where it's possible. They don't maybe necessarily invest in it. They haven't invested in education and research. So all of these things really do need to come together for it to work. But just because you don't have an ideology doesn't mean you can't develop. We've seen, I mean, if you think of missiles, if you think of the space shuttle and America's space program, a lot of that was based upon the Nazi rocket program that they had. And the Nazis weren't exactly ideological. You know, they were racist. So despite not having an ideology, they actually technologically developed. But their purpose was we're superior, we need to conquer Europe. That is what drove them. And in fact, war is quite central to technological development. You find World War II and World War I were some of the key, they were the key eras where technology actually developed. For war and innovation actually go hand in hand.
Obviously, we've discussed how China is now challenging the West, particularly the US. What if we go back a little? How did the West come to lead the world in tech in the first place?
For three reasons. Colonialism. They went around the world, subjugated people. They raped the country. They took their resources. If you look at what they did to India, 25% of global GDP when the British turned up. And when they left, they turned into a poster child of poverty. If you look at the Caribbean, how did Europeans get to America? They went up, they went there and went there as settlers. If you look at South Africa, if you look at Australia. So the needs of colonialism, you know, you needed ships, you needed weapons, you need administration when you go to these countries. So this drove a lot of development. Then you got capitalism. When capitalism emerged in Europe, it was all about producing more and more so you can make profit. It was all about consumption. So this drove the development of the factory floor and everything that came really around for managing a factory and production. And then probably the Reformation. Prior to, I think we've got to keep in mind that Europe was a backwater, 14, 1500s. The Roman Empire had collapsed in around the 400s or the Western Roman Empire. And the church really then came to dominate the political affairs of Europe. And the church, you know, their view was Rome is the center of the world. The planet is the center of the universe. You know, they had this funny view. So what you found with Christianity actually held, or the church actually, to be more precise, it held scientific development back. And that's why Galileo and these guys are famous today, because they challenged some of the basic teachings of the church. So once the Europeans got rid of the church when it came to political affairs, when it came to politics, what you then find is scientific thinking started to develop, scientific method came to develop, inquiry, being critical about nature around you. But prior to that, Christianity gave you all the answers and it's heresy to question it. So colonialism, capitalism, Reformation are quite central to the tech lead that the Europeans managed to develop.
Why have no other nations or civilizations been able to become a global tech player? So to give an example, the Muslim world, there's plenty of people there. There's resources, there's wealth. So if we're talking about the equivalent venture capitalists, the thinkers, the scientists, Why haven't they been able to invent new tech?
There's a number of reasons to this. Firstly, take the Muslim world as a specific example, there's no vision from the rulers. There's no long-term planning. There's no way they want to get to. Really, a lot of it's just mimicking what they see in the West. No vision. There's no long-term thinking. If you look at the Arab world, most rulers really are still tribal. If you look at the Saud family, if you look at the Gulf leaders, these are tribes that used to fight each other, and now they've got countries. They're still very tribal in their thinking. And their view is, we've got so much money, we can just buy everything. So no wonder Donald Trump went to the Middle East when he went to collect taxes. These people are just prepared to pay. Now, anyone can actually develop tech, but it needs to be coordinated. Money needs to be put in. And you don't see this level of planning in the Muslim world. In fact, they're thinking very short term, or it's just mimic the West. But, you know, we have to keep in mind the Europeans were backward once. The Europeans were divided once. The Europeans were a backwater once. China was a backwater once. So these things can change. So even though there's a lack of vision and thinking, nationalism today, you know, that can be changed going forward.
I've got a few questions about specific tech that's coming out, specific tech that's going to influence the future massively. So if we look at a few industries, the big one at the moment is AI and communications. If you could kind of just give us a few words, your thoughts on these industries.
Yeah, so AI is the buzzword at the moment. I think we're still in the early period of AI. It shows a lot of promise. It's a general purpose technology, which will probably lead to the creation of other industries like the internet did. And what you've got at the moment is AI needs to be integrated more and more deeply into human activities. So things like autonomous robots, vehicles, drones, this seems to be the area we're going. At the moment, really, we're still in the early period of AI, although it seems to be rapidly moving forward. Now, the two areas which are critical to AI is natural language processing and the large language models that we have. So natural language processing is the ability of a system to understand and explain in a certain language. And AI can do this on its own. And the large language models is how AI actually works. So when you do a prompt, the AI interprets it, gives it a weighting, and it gives you output. So because of the processing power we have, there's a lot of potential for this. So what at the moment a lot of AI companies are trying to do is they're trying to develop these AI models so they can integrate these into human activities. So, you know, you got it on your phone, so it does a lot of things for you. But what people want is, I want to use it in my vehicle. We want to be able to use it on drones so drones can just operate on their own. You want to be able to sit in the car, the famous Hollywood film where you sit in the car and the car just drives you to where you want to go. So that's where AI and communications really is at the moment. And, you know, there's a lot of hope for this going forward.
What about the microchip?
So really, for AI to work, we need more powerful chips. So the processing power that AI needs is immense. So we're going to need more and more powerful chips. So at the moment, IBM, they've developed probably the most advanced chip, which is the 2-nanometer chip. If you find most products, we've got 4-nanometer chips, and Chinese are doing about 6 to 7-nanometer chips. So we're getting to a point where we're getting to 1-nanometer. And that is going to create a lot of challenges, because what we need is completely new architecture and materials. We're using silicon at the moment. We're getting more and more transistors onto silicon, but we're now getting to the basic molecular level. So there's only so much smaller you can go. So what you're seeing already, there's a lot of research going on using new materials, can they actually work, and even new architecture as well. And what you find is that America and China actually leading in this particular area.
I've been hearing a lot about quantum technology. What actually is it, and will it change the world?
So quantum technology, it's now the solution to the great processing power that we need. And what quantum technology does, it leverages the principles of quantum mechanics. So at a very basically, if you remember, normal computers, they use ones and zeros to represent a flowing current. What quantum technology does is it can be both at the same time. So what that means is it can handle way more data and it can actually understand much, much faster as well. We're still at the really early stage of quantum technology. Although there's a lot of hope, we're really even still at the theoretical stage at the moment. There is a concept in quantum technology and quantum thinking. It's called quantum entanglement. So in normal computers, we have the base unit is 1 byte. In quantum technology, what you have is 1 qubit. And these qubits, we're at a molecular level now. That's the discussion quantum technology is at. These qubits are linked to one another, no matter how far apart they are. So this now gives rise to more secure communication. This gives rise to more secure communication going forward. So what quantum technology is going to do is it promises revolutionary advancements in computing power because of the way it works. It promises more secure communication, which is obviously necessary for military purposes. And it will actually allow measurements of much more precision. But there's still a long way to really go in this particular area.
What about advanced materials?
So when we're talking about advanced materials, what we're talking about really is like nanotechnology and things like that. And at the moment, the research into advanced materials is focused on engineering them to possess superior properties, yeah? So things like strength, flexibility, conductivity, and these sort of things. And developing materials for polymers, coatings, anti-microbial and hygienic materials, this is where a lot of the research is going on at the moment. In nanomaterials, China actually leads at the moment. China is actually the world leader in research when it comes to nanomaterials. So what this means is you can make very small machines which have immense power. We can make buildings which are earthquake-proof. And advanced materials will actually be, it is actually already an era of competition between the powers.
Another big area, biotechnology.
So synthetic biology is probably the most nascent of the biotechnologies, and it's an emerging technology on par actually with quantum technology. And this field, it involves redesigning living organisms into ones with new functions, with applications in medicine, manufacturing, and agriculture. And again, it's another area where China really leads the research.
And finally, energy. Everyone's on about energy.
So yeah, the battle to find alternative fossil fuels, it's been going on for probably over a decade. And this has seen the emergence really of renewable energy sources and other technologies. At the moment, the main area really of development and research is electric batteries and the electrification of transport. And what we've seen is a huge battery innovation in this area. For China, for example, it's invented supercapacitors. This is an energy storage device that bridges the gap between traditional capacitors and rechargeable batteries. So you could run small industry off this. You could run, and all of this is being run off something that's not linked to the electric grid. So again, what you find is China really is leading in this area.
Finally, Adnan, I wanted to get your view on particular concepts, which really are a capitalistic view. And they are considered essential for innovation. One thing is innovation is all about research and development.
So research and development is really important for innovation, but it's really simplistic to say that only research and development leads to innovation. And the innovation process, it required the coming together of so many different parts, financial institutions, research and educational bodies, public sector funds, intermediary institutions. And it's not just about research and development labs. So what this shows you is innovation is quite a complex process. It's a collective process, and actually it's quite an uncertain process as well. So it requires a whole ecosystem. You can't really just put this down to research and development equals innovation. It's not as simple as that.
What about this thing about small, medium enterprises being critical for innovation?
So yeah, this is a common argument that you hear that, you know, SMEs are critical. Look at Silicon Valley, you look at in Japan. And while SMEs can be part of the innovation ecosystem, this assumption that smallness is beautiful or inherently critical for innovation, again, is quite simplistic. You know, innovation is a bit more complex than that. We've got to keep in mind that a lot of SMEs actually fail. In fact, many new businesses actually fail in the first year. So that isn't really a positive thing when you're talking about SMEs. And what you see in a lot of policies that really just small business enterprises, and maybe supporting SMEs doesn't on its own lead to innovation. In fact, the research shows that what SMEs need is just a level playing field. If there's a level playing field, they will prosper. So just, you know, focusing on small, medium enterprises on its own doesn't lead to innovation.
Everyone believes that innovation is about risk taking, and really it's only venture capitalists that are willing to take that risk. What's your view on this?
Yeah, venture capital firm, there's a lot of myths around them. And, you know, we've got to keep in mind that venture capital firms, they tend to prefer projects where commercial viability is already established and they will make a profit within a relatively short period of time. We're talking 3 to 5 years. So what you find in venture capital firms, they're not really looking 10, 20 years ahead. There's this thing that's made up that, you know, venture capital firms, without them, how can you innovate? But the reality here is, you know, their horizon is actually very, very short. So this short-term bias is actually quite damaging for scientific development and for innovation. If you look at the emergence of biotechnology, nanotechnology, and the internet, well, venture capital didn't arrive until 15, 20 years after the most significant risky investments were made. And who were they made by? The public sector. They were made by government. In fact, the state provides most of the early finance when venture capital runs away. Venture capital seems to invest when they can see this is commercially viable and they can see they can make quite a quick profit around it. So actually, there's not a direct correlation between venture capital and innovation. It's really a myth.
What do you think the relationship is between patents and innovation, if there is one?
This is probably the biggest myth you get in this particular area. Now, the rise in patent numbers, particularly in industries like pharmaceuticals, doesn't necessarily correlate with innovations. In fact, patents are not a direct or reliable indicator of innovation. And while they can serve strategic purposes for firms, if you want to attract venture capital, on their own, they don't actually mean much. Now, innovation, as I mentioned, is a complex process. It involves research and development, networks, complementary assets, risk-taking. And actually, patents have actually proven to hold innovation back. And I'll give you an example of 3D printing. 3D printing, the patent was made by two brothers in the 1980s. And what happened was, is they couldn't work out how they could commercialize this technology. So what did they do? They just sat on it. So for 20 years, they did nothing with the patent. Once the patent ran out and other people could look at the technology and do something with it, now it's become widespread. Now it's become widespread, and that's how we've come to hear about it. So what you find is what companies do is they patent everything, even though they've not made a commercial decision of are they going to actually take this to the market. So what happened is a lot of patents sit on the shelf and they don't get used until they actually expire. So patents... actually, now all the research says patents actually holds back innovation.
And another common idea that floats around is that the government actually hinders innovation. And it's really the private sector which is leading the game.
Yeah, so this is a very pro-private sector argument. And if we take the example of the iPhone, because the Apple really gets a lot of credit for innovation. But what you find is if you take apart the iPhone, there's nothing in the iPhone that Apple innovated. In fact, all the technology that existed, Apple just brought them together in a mobile phone device. So you find many of the most significant technological advancements that underpin modern industries, they actually trace their origins and early funding back to government investment. So think of the internet, think of GPS. Touchscreen displays, even Siri voice recognition, all of the early research funding actually was the government. So what companies do is these technologies exist, however, they've not been commercialized yet. So they then bring them together in devices or instruments or products that the public might want. So actually, the last thing you want is the government to get out of the way for innovation. In fact, what you find is unless the government doesn't invest in certain industries, the private sector won't invest in them because the private sector is not looking at 10, 20 years ahead. They're thinking in 5 years, we're going to make a profit. That's too long a project. We're not going to bother with it. So actually, the last thing we really need for government to get out of the way. In fact, the government is an entrepreneurial state. They're the ones that make the early investment that the private sector is not even prepared to actually do.
I think that answer might upset a lot of Apple fans out there. Finally, Adnan, what's the relationship between the free market and innovation?
So the argument is, or the narrative is you know, you have a free market, there's competition going on, and this forces companies to innovate in order to remain productive and to compete with other service providers. But there's no evidence for this. All the research confirmed that this isn't the case. In fact, what you find, the internet, it was invented without there being the free market. In fact, it was DARPA, the American department that invented it. I mentioned GPS wasn't invented by the private sector. It was invented by DARPA, who saw that there was a need for these instruments. So really, the free market being the primary driver of innovation is actually a myth. It's actually never existed. What the private sector is good at is commercializing things. So what they can do is take something and make it a mass consumption device. So the smartphone actually existed before the iPhone. You know, you had BlackBerry, you had Nokia. But what Apple did was they brought together a GPS, a mobile phone tech. You've got the microchip. You've got the iPod. And they brought it together. In fact, the only thing in the Apple that was innovated was the operating system, which comes from Apple. All the hardware actually already existed. So what Apple's really good at is commercializing existing technology. And that's where the private sector comes in. They can take a technology and they can commercialize it, but they're only going to commercialize it if they believe there's profit in it. If they don't believe this is viable, it won't actually get to the market. So again, you know, all these arguments, really, including the free market equals innovation, these are very simplistic arguments. Innovation is a much more complex process. There's actually a lot of moving parts. It's not as straightforward as if you do, you know, if you have venture capital firms, if you have a large private sector, government gets out the way, you'll have innovation. In fact, what we find is the government's actually been involved in every key innovation.
Adnan, thank you for your time today. To the audience, keep an eye out for our deep dive on the geopolitics of technology, which we'll be dropping soon on our website. As usual, you can learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, article, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.